This is Festival Showcase, a weekly interview program that explores the artists and music behind the 2015 season of the Aspen Music Festival and School and previews upcoming performances. This program comes to you from Aspen Public Radio, the official voice of the Aspen Music Festival and School, and can be heard online at aspenpublicradio.org. Today we'll talk with composer Christopher Theofanidis, pianist Joyce Yang, and cantor Rollin Simmons. Composer Christopher Theofanidis' one-act opera, The Cows of Apollo, or The Invention of Music, will be performed at the Wheeler Opera House this Thursday and Saturday. Tickets are still available, and here's Chris. Chris, before we talk about your opera, I want to kind of go backwards a little bit. And for you, it's probably backwards pretty far, about 15 years, and that's Rainbow Body. Because when I asked Alan Fletcher at the end of the season in an interview last year, what was your biggest surprise at the Aspen Music Festival? And he said, not that Chris Theofanidis' work was really good, because I knew it was good, but I did not expect the response that I got, the standing ovation. Oh. And when he saw that, he was really surprised that a 21st century work had such a tremendous success with the audience. How many times has it been performed? Has it been like 100 times or something? And have you been seeing standing ovations a lot for that work?
Yeah, you know, it's been an amazing thing for me, because the piece has been done now by over 150 orchestras. And so in some of those multiple times, so in a 15-year period. So, and I owe a lot of that to Maestro Spano, actually, who recorded it earlier. Early on.
Yes.
Yeah, it's been a warhorse almost for me in a way, which has been great. And yeah, I mean, I think it's a romantic tone poem in a sense. And I think also I didn't shy away from big emotion in a way, kind of a big arc in the piece. And I think that some people have expressed that they enjoyed that aspect of it a lot.
Do you feel like a 21st century composer in the sense that the break between audience and composer, it seems to be healing now? I wonder if you feel like you're a part of that.
That's a great question. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that 20th century was a century of worry for artists and how they fit in and what they're trying to say. And it was a real existential 100-year crisis in a way.
Yes.
And I do think I felt like I caught the tail end of that in my own schooling. I saw that in kind of the vestiges of my teachers' training and that kind of thing, but certainly don't see it in the students that I have, for instance. And I don't feel it to the extent that I did when I was in school. It feels very much everybody is kind of supportive of the artist's journey, trying to get to someplace that's real for them. And that takes a lot of different paths.
Speaking as a teacher, I'd like to ask you to talk about that next, because in the early 1970s, I attempted to go to music conservatory. And because I was writing melodies, even though I liked Schoenberg, I was writing melodies, and therefore I got nothing but discouragement from four different composition professors at different conservatories, and I gave up and went into music journalism. The reason I'm telling you that is because they would say things like, no serious composer ever writes a melody, or you can do whatever you want after you get out of this class, but I'm going to teach you the 12-tone serial technique, and that's it. Nowadays, it seems as though if you have 10 or 12 students in a program of composition, you're going to have 10 or 12 styles, one influenced by jazz, one kind of world music, one maybe going back to serialism. How do you as a teacher cultivate a broad enough palette so that you can be receiving what young composers today are doing? Because it was a lot easier back in the 70s as a teacher.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. I think basically in that period that you were talking about, there was a kind of a feeling that we were not trying to do certain things that had been done before. I mean, it was a kind of a negative starting place, which is a terrible way to create art.
Right, composition by avoidance.
By avoidance, yeah.
Yes.
And so what's left is often very paltry,
yes.
Slim pickings, so to speak. So, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, now all you have to do is, I mean, even historically, if you were to look in the 19th century and you look at feuds between Brahms and Wagner and things like that, or later Schoenberg and Stravinsky, you would hate to think of the music history without one of those figures, and they were polar extremes and drew criticism from the other side. And all you have to do is think about that for a minute to realize that it has nothing to do with stylistic meaning. It has only to do with commitment and an essence of a voice. And the way, as a teacher, I try to do that anyway, is really probe what the student loves as a starting point. And then the critical apparatus that we learn in schools is basically, how does that music work? What really makes it work at the level that you're connecting with it? And to understand that is a starting point for what you're doing. And in the end, we're all synthesis of all these different things. I mean, you know, when I think about, you mentioned world music, that's a big part of my own kind of love.
Sure.
And classical music, and these things are kind of in some strange proportion in my music, and they've kind of fused and become a, you know, hopefully a voice. Part of it is awakening that in a student and trying to get them to go deep with those things and let them live in them and swim in them enough that they become a synthesized voice.
Let's talk about this comic opera, and there's actually going to be two of them, two one acts that are being performed, you and Stephen Stuckey. Did the two of you conspire at all in the creation of this evening? Because in some strange way, they remind me of each other. One about the beginning of music, one about the end of music.
That's a really good point. Actually, they initially had nothing to do with each other. My piece is from 2001 originally, and it was done at the Brooklyn Academy of Music, and Robert Spano was the conductor. And Ed Berkeley, who's the director here, was the director. And there, and Tim Long, okay, who's the musical coach, was the musical coach. So there's a kind of a coming full circle for this piece. Mm-hmm. This piece is brilliant. I literally just came from a rehearsal of his, and it is hysterical. Mm-hmm. And you're right. It's kind of his opera is about Mozart, Beethoven, and Haydn basically come back from heaven in search of meaning and what's happened to classical music and that kind of thing. And my piece has something to do with the birth of music as told by the ancient Greeks. There's a whole genre of theater that the ancient Greek world had called satyr plays, and they were basically one-act, very short kind of sorbet comedies that were meant to kind of be put in between two tragedies in an evening. And they often use the same characters as the tragedies. So Sophocles actually wrote a number of these, of which half of one exists, and that's what this is based on. It's about the invention of music.
I see.
And the guy who I worked with on the libretto, William Hoffman, who's a fantastic librettist and author, he wrote As Is on Broadway and John Corigliano's Ghost of Versailles libretto, maybe you
yes.
know that. He really pulled out all the stops, and I mean, it's been really hilarious, but he wanted to call it The Cows of Apollo or The Invention of Music. He said, you'll appreciate the title The Cows of Apollo in a few years after you get older. And in fact, he was right. It's a very slapsticky kind of comedy.
Mm-hmm. If you could share with us very generally, verbally, what kind of style of music people can expect.
The great thing about musical theater, opera, you know, anything that has to do with the stage is that the drama really justifies almost anything, which is fantastic. So the opening of the piece, for instance, is a bacchanal, and Bacchus, the god Bacchus, leads the maenads and the satyrs into kind of revelry and ecstasy. And so it's a very sensual, romantic musical language that happens there. Basically, in a nutshell, the story is that the god Apollo has discovered that his sacred cows have been stolen, and he discovers that it's his half-brother Hermes who's done the stealing, and Hermes is actually a kind of rock and roll character who doesn't care about anybody but himself, and so he literally is a heavy metal singer in the opera, and he has a rock band accompaniment and that kind of thing. So those are kinds of things that I normally probably wouldn't do in a straight orchestral piece or something, but had a lot of fun doing in a dramatic context, and the character of Hermes was very much in that line. So a lot of the musical styles grow kind of organically out of the characters.
Do both of you find a place in these comedies for bringing out the human heart? A good comedy, for me, is a bit wrenching sometimes.
Yeah.
Do you feel like there's a little bit of that in yours or in his?
No, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think in both cases. I mean, you know, the kind of comic situation in his is that Beethoven, Mozart, and Haydn have read an article in the New York Times in which the proclamation is made classical music is dead. Mm-hmm. And so they come back to figure out what to do about this situation, essentially. That has both comedic but also poignant kind of undertones, and both of those are handled really well in that piece. And in my piece, the idea that something which has a crude impetus can be brought into focus and kind of made to go deep and be artful and say something that is binding to everyone. Mm-hmm. That is the impulse of Hermes, the kind of enfant terrible who takes this electric guitar and is just going berserk. And then the god Apollo takes that and turns it into the same material, turns it into something which is spun out as a melody. And so there are kind of themes like that that come out that are kind of suddenly poignant in a way.
So back in 2000, you composed Rainbow Body. This opera you composed maybe around 2001.
Right.
Can you tell us about works that you're either just now completing or that have just recently seen the light of day?
Sure. Thanks for asking. Well, the most recent piece I've done is 80-minute work for chorus, orchestra, soloists, and narrators, and video, and the kitchen sink, in a way. Mm-hmm. And it's called Creation Creator, and it was also premiered by Atlanta. It's the latest thing that, and we just recorded it as well. And it has to do with different voices and disciplines talking about creating and the act of creation and, you know, how they kind of come together and form a big picture and a big conversation about that. So that's one of the more recent pieces. And yeah, I have, you know, it's endless source of possibilities, you know, when a project is proposed, because you can kind of steer a little bit the subject matter.
Sure.
And wherever your local interests are at the time, that can become your life for a while.
If you've just joined us, this is Festival Showcase on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Chris Moore, and I've been interviewing composer Christopher Theofanidis and talking about his one-act opera, The Cows of Apollo, or The Invention of Music, which gets performed at the Wheeler Opera House this Thursday and Saturday. Tickets are still available, and you can contact them at aspenmusicfestival.com. Now let's hear pianist Joyce Yang, who performs with the Aspen Philharmonic Orchestra on Wednesday evening in two different pieces, as well as in a recital with violinist Augustine Hadelick. Joyce, this concert Wednesday with the orchestra is one of two things that you're doing, but let's talk about that one first, because you have two pieces that I think have very, very different characters about them. Is it the Faya, the Nights in the Garden of Spain first, which I think of as very sunny and just, even though it's nights, but still it's celebratory, it's joyous. And then you have Totentanz, and that's a really heavy one. Tell us a little bit about the Faya first and why you enjoy playing this one so much, because I think this is not your first round with it.
The Faya's Nights in the Gardens of Spain, it's a very symphonic work, in my opinion. I really do feel like I am an extension of the orchestra, not this diva soloist that pops out and starts doing her own thing and expecting everyone else to follow. It's very colorful. For me, many different kinds of jewel tones. I always see colors when I hear music, and maybe that's what you mean by bright, and it glistens in a certain way. There's all these textures in the piano and in the harp and all different parts of the orchestra that make that shimmery sound that's maybe lights reflecting off of the water with the moonlight or the stars, or there's a certain mystery to the piece that evokes wonderful perfume in the air immediately when the music takes off. And I think every great piece transforms the mood instantly and makes you travel far, far away and places you've never been. And I think this piece, as soon as it starts, you're at a different place and you're beginning a fantastic journey. I very much enjoy playing it. I'm usually the detail, the highlight to the section. Maybe not the main force, but I am that final eyelash when the painter is done painting. I get to do little things that change the course of the piece and how it's flowing. And I just like roaring with the rest of the orchestra. It's a very, it's like I've joined an army of musicians and we're full force all together, and it's a lot of fun.
Now, the other piece is very, very different in character, Totentanz of Liszt. Even as a young man, Liszt was obsessed with death. I don't know if you know these stories. He would go to graveyards and to gambling dens and to death row and visit inmates who are facing death and that sort of thing. This is obviously a much darker work in terms of texture. Tell us a little bit about this work. And is this your first time playing this work, or is this something that you have played with other orchestras?
Liszt Totentanz is definitely a very showy, virtuosic, full of surprises, just enormous work for the piano solo. Then there's the orchestra. I think this is very different from Faya's Nights in the Gardens of Spain. I come in first with roaring from the bottom of the keyboard, which will be a huge shock after the Faya, because Faya just goes away like magic, like smoke, like it never happened. And you hear this absolute pianissimo pits from the entire orchestra, and that's how the piece ends. And for me to come back out and start this stomping sort of King Kong-like gesture.
Right.
Very rude. I mean, it'll be a very rude awakening mm-hmm. after the Defiah, and to begin this variation, theme and variation on the Dies Irae theme that's, I think we've heard in many different pieces that goes ta da 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 da. So just on this theme, the whole piece is built, and each variation is more spectacular than the other. And it basically is written for the hands of Franz Liszt that could do anything. And it just gets more and more gnarly and more and more hectic. And in a way, it's sort of like a fourth movement, of course, completely separate fourth movement. But after the three movements of the Defiah, this is like that fiery fourth movement that you may crave after such ambient and
so
surreal. The perfume just shatters with glass.
Right.
And now we're faced with maybe a brutal reality or something entirely different. And in a way, I think it's very, very gratifying. It's a new work for me, and I've meant to want to play it for a while. I remember hearing it saying, oh, one day I'll get my fingers into that work, and it's finally that time, and I'm happy to be playing it. In motivic way, this might be a bit far-fetched, but in the Defiah's Nights in the Gardens of Spain, he plays around with this chromaticism. The main theme goes ta da 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 dum, ta da 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 dum, ta da 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 dum. There's that play between the minor seconds.
Mm-hmm.
And after you hear that so many times, you hear in the Totentanz the ta da da ya da da da, which is also kind of a theme that plays around with the second. So I felt in a way they could really go well together without really knowing why. And certain textures are in a way slightly similar. There's a lot of glissando going on, of course. Very, very different kind of approach to playing a glissando in the Defiah. Touch will be very light. I'll try to create more waves, whereas a glissando in the Liszt is more of a rip. It's like the shriek across the keyboard. So there's that similar technical element in it that might tie it together.
One of the challenges for many of us as listeners when it comes to Liszt is that on the one hand, there seems to be a sincere person there. On the other hand, he does so much with virtuosity and so much with shock value. I don't know if Totentanz is a work that is really more about virtuosity and shock value than it really is about a contemplation of death. I mean, do you have a sense from the content of the work how you may want to approach it as far as the very serious issue of death?
I think there's definitely sublime in parts of this piece where he just abandons that the fear and the dramatic nature that we associate with death, something very sudden and scary. And then maybe he's exploring his thoughts on afterlife. There are sudden flashes of complete weightlessness, anti-gravity sections that are pianissimo, and suddenly everyone drops out and I'm just twinkling on top. And I think when I first listened to Totentanz, it's quite a while ago, these moments are the ones that actually really stood out. We expect the super virtuosity from a Liszt concerto, and then somewhere along the line, he does go to that very private and real and completely the opposite place from what he wants to prove. I don't know if he decided to go there or it just appeared itself. And I think those moments are very special. And I do want to highlight those because there's such small quantity of them. And I mm-hmm. think that's where it's truly beautiful. It's not trying to be anything. It's not trying to prove anything. It just creeps out, and you would only recognize it as Liszt. It doesn't sound like anything else. It sounds like you're improvising in a way, but it's so beautifully arced also. And so I think it's that maybe even a personal inner fight between the two forces, sort of like in a Schumann way. Maybe there is a Liszt Jekyll and Hyde there also.
Yes, it could
and
be.
We're exploring all sides, of course, and it's all very autobiographical. I think all the compositions of great minds, but this does explore many, many different ends. So however you look at it, I think there's definitely real sublime and honesty to many of the places.
That's especially interesting when you think of an audience who would be watching this, because they may have lost a spouse or a dear friend or somebody very close to them. So there is that level of it being right in the face of many, many people in the audience. And yet, of course, at the same time, Liszt is asking you to be this crazed virtuoso.
Yeah, I have to be many things.
So you do. And I'm interested in how you, Joyce, how you may want to communicate to this audience all the different levels of what's going on in this Liszt piece.
I guess the bottom line would be I have to do what I believe in with the pieces. I can't really tell myself to transform in a certain way, mm-hmm. play in the way I wish I could. In the performance, I often say I have all these plans, but everything goes out the window. I just sound like my embarrassing self, and you really just can't hide from it. And this is the kind of piece that in the beginning, you truly let go. You mm-hmm. let go, and it is the dance of the death, and you see where the dance takes you, and you have to believe in the composition that it will take you to places. And I think the scariest thing for me is to stop worrying how it's going to come off or whether I'm going to reach that almost impossible arpeggio. Mm-hmm. You just mm-hmm. have to, in a phrase, let it rip. And mm-hmm. or just simply jump off the cliff. You know what to do, hopefully. You just have to take that best jump you can and hope that you make it. And it's one of those pieces that right. you can say like, oh, but what if maybe I should jump a little more carefully? If that happens, then I think that extremity is just missing. So might as well let it go all the way and, you know, risk it.
We've been talking with pianist Joyce Yang here on Festival Showcase on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Chris Moore, just reminding you also that you can hear her on Wednesday, the 29th of July, for her concert with the Aspen Philharmonic Orchestra at 6 p.m., and then on Thursday, July 30th, in recital with violinist Augustine Hadelick. Now let's change gears a little bit. On August 4th at 5 p.m. at the Aspen District Theater, the Aspen Jewish Congregation, directed by cantor Roland Simmons, presents The Man Upstairs, Questioning God Through Music. Let's hear what cantor Rollins has to say.
Yeah, I think questioning is really central to being Jewish mm-hmm. and something that I love about Judaism, that you don't have to have all the answers. Mm-hmm. Which I think played a lot into my own becoming a cantor. I think before I decided to pursue that career, I thought I had to have it all figured out.
Right.
And I was very intimidated by But this idea that my own clergy, my own cantor and rabbis, they already knew the answers. They believed in God for sure. That's just what I assumed. And then once I sat down and talked with them and asked them, do you believe in God? And the answer was not so clear cut.
Right.
And I think it was very reassuring for me. I don't have to have it all figured out. And maybe I could do this profession of being a cantor.
And then this thing that you've brought together, this event that you brought together, the man upstairs questioning God through music, in a sense, is another way then of comforting yourself and making it okay to be a questioner, because the musical tradition of the Jewish faith is also one of a lot of questioning.
Yes, exactly. And I think one of my main missions of my career is to really show people that it's okay to not know. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of assuming that people have it all figured out. If you come to services and you look around and you see that, oh, everyone else knows all the prayers, they must really know what they're doing. And the truth is they don't. Right. You know, they're probably either pretending or, you know, maybe they have some ideas of their own. And most of them are questioning just as much as the next person. So,
well, tell us a little bit about the musical tradition itself. I mean, off the top of my head, I think, of course, Leonard Bernstein, a lot of questioning in a lot of the music that he's written as well. And of course, Fiddler on the Roof. But I'm sure you have a rich variety of other examples here that some of which you'll be playing and performing with the people you're bringing in.
Yeah, we have one Leonard Bernstein selection, which is something I had never actually heard before. It's from his Mass, and it's called Credo. And the words are really fantastic.
I believe in God, but does God believe in me? I'll believe in any God, if any God there be. That's a pact, shake on that, no taking back. I believe in one God, but then I believe in three. I'll believe in 20 gods, if they'll believe in me. That's a pact.
It just asks all these questions. I'll believe in 30 gods if they believe in me. And just this constant questioning. So I really love, and it's also has some humor.
Right.
You know, he's always good at that.
I imagine there's a lot of humor in a lot of, when you have the nerve to question God, you've got to have a sense of humor about it and hope that God does too.
Definitely. And I was really looking for music and lyrics that had some humor to them, which was sometimes challenging to find. I have a few more popular songs that aren't actually Jewish, but we're sort of taking them and looking at them through a Jewish lens, but sort of questioning this character of God, and like in God Shuffled His Feet, which is by this group, the Crash Test Dummies. And it's just the story of God with the people wandering around in the garden after creation and sort of questioning God. Like, if I lost my eye, would it show up in heaven? And God comes back with this sort of odd little story. And I don't know. So I just like these lyrics that play with this idea a little bit. But I would say this, a more traditional style of Jewish singing, which is called chazanut, is a way of expressing the text through a really beautiful, often recitative kind of style. And I'll be singing something, the text is Avinu Malkeinu, something that many people know from our high holiday services, but a melody that will be different for people. And it's in this chazanut style. And it's really, you hear the crying in the way the melody just, it has so much emotion to it.
We've been hearing an excerpt from Mizmor Leila, a song from last summer's Jewish music program produced by cantor Roland Simmons and the Aspen Jewish Congregation. On August 4th at 5 p.m. at the Aspen District Theater, the Aspen Jewish Congregation and cantor Roland Simmons presents The Man Upstairs, Questioning God Through Music. For ticket information, visit aspenjewish.org. This has been Festival Showcase, a weekly interview program that explores the artists and music behind the 2015 season of the Aspen Music Festival and School, and occasionally some other special events, and previews upcoming performances. Please join me Tuesdays at 3:30 and Saturdays at 3 p.m. for more interviews. My name is Chris Moore.